You're listening to The Crunch with Cam Slater, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Gary Moller is a nutritionist and an endurance athlete. During the COVID debacle, he popped his head above the parapet and has been lobbying against the therapeutics bill. We discuss an article he wrote for the BFD where he swapped his support from ACT to New Zealand First and do a bit of a deep dive on that, where things are heading now after the election, and discuss the lost opportunities for the freedom movement after the election. He joins me now. Welcome to The Crunch.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You're most welcome. Now, you wrote an article for us before the election on the BFD, and you've talked about that with Paul Brennan, but I think for this discussion, it might be a good idea to do a bit of just to revise what you said back then and then talk about if anything's changed in your point of view since the election that resonates with that article that you wrote for us back then.
Well, I guess the question is, where do we start, Cam? Because there are so many things to cover and so many twists and turns. And in addition to that, I've spent the last week or so having a post-election detox. So, the original goal was that for the so-called freedom movement and people who were felt they were disenfranchised, not represented by the existing political parties, we needed to get representation in Parliament. And to do so, we had to get either MPs into the electorates or else have sufficient party vote to get past 5%. And so those became the criteria, the minimum.
Yes.
We needed to get past those thresholds. And we saw from the Tauranga and Hamilton by-elections and also the Australian state and federal elections that the greatest danger for us was the splitting of the vote, the proliferation of minor parties, all with admirable objectives, wonderful policies, great leaders, but in the end, the one percenters and no electorates. So we had to unite the parties. And one of the tactics that I implemented very early on was to, instead of recreating the wheel, is to look at a existing political party that best reflected the so-called freedom movement and adopt it.
Yeah, that's a strategy I've talked about often, that people who are invested in a particular outcome and are very passionate about that. And a case in point is the Libertarian Party, if you remember back in the day.
Sure.
You know, Lindsay Perigo was involved with that. A number of other people that I respect have been involved in that. But ultimately, they were a bunch of very energetic, politically aware people, enthusiastic, but were largely on the outside of the tent shouting to be let in and were never let in. And I had suggested to them back in the day that they should take their enthusiasm and infect other parties with that enthusiasm, and by using political osmosis, inoculate the political parties that they then join and become with their particular brand of libertarianism and freedom. And I saw that as being, you know, in this last election, another valid way of doing that. Now, you had dabbled with trying to do that with the ACT Party, didn't you?
Yes. Well, first of all, just what you were describing there, the socialists or communists infiltrating and taking over the Green Party, my Green Party, is a very good example of where an existing political party with all of its established infrastructure and that was simply taken over.
Yeah.
And we no longer have a Green Party, do we? We have an a la New Zealand Communist Party.
Yeah, it's a Marxist Maoist party with a green tinge in reality. You know, and literally, you know, they're described as watermelons, green on the outside and deeply red on the inside. And that is true about the Green Party.
Absolutely. And I was very involved in the green movement and am now deeply disappointed and disillusioned. But that aside, when I looked at the ACT Party, I looked closely at their constitution, and it was as if it had been custom written 20 years ago with today in mind, with our needs in mind. It was the perfect party.
Yeah.
So quietly, I rallied my friends, supporters, and we all started joining the ACT Party. And we started that 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I made sure that David Seymour was familiar. I copied him in on some of my correspondence and so on, because I didn't want to be doing anything underhand.
Yeah.
Honesty, integrity, those are very
big
important.
Big pluses, qualities. But also a handicap in politics, if I just quietly add.
Yeah, you're right. And we've seen plenty of that just over, election, we saw plenty of that.
Just take Jacinda Ardern, remember? You know, she stood there before the 2017 election and told us that she'd never told a lie and believed that politicians could have a career in politics without lying. And at the time she did that, I said, well, that was the first lie right there, you know, that she had never told a lie.
That's right. Yes, it certainly was many of those examples, they're certainly real reality checks as to what we have to deal with. But Cameron, I'll do my best, my utmost to maintain my own integrity and honesty and not stoop to underhand tactics.
Yeah.
So we sought to basically join the ACT Party, get involved, and change the culture of it to better reflect, what you would call libertarian values, by the way.
Yeah. Freedom.
Yes, that's right. And the perfect party for Lindsay Perigo.
It's funny, you know, because David Seymour talks a huge game on freedom of speech.
Yeah.
But when a whole lot of Kiwis tipped up at Parliament to exercise their freedom of speech, he wouldn't talk to them.
Yes, that was very disappointing. But I didn't see that as an impediment to start with. So we did what we did. We joined the party. The numbers were increasing. It was proceeding very nicely.
Mm.
And then things changed. They changed.
Is there a time frame for that? So you think it was early this year, not late last year?
Early this year, things changed for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but over the previous, since the first lockdowns, the idea of joining an existing party, becoming it, and it becoming us was the strategy. And I was going quietly. And in addition to that, testing the model, and began creating a website to launch it as a national program.
Yeah.
And then the Therapeutic Products Act, legislation was introduced.
Yeah.
And I took a read of it and went, holy shit, this is terrible. We'd already fought it. We'd been fighting it since 2007. I'm talking about the natural health industry.
Yes.
And on each occasion that the government of the day tried to introduce it, Winston Peters basically had it thrown out.
Yep.
And at the same time, it became obvious that Winston Peters was back in the political game.
Yeah.
So we had those two things coming together, Winston Peters and the Therapeutic Products Bill. And as a matter of honor, we had to go with Winston.
Right, that's a significant change to go from ACT to New Zealand First.
Well, yes, but you see, Winston had saved my bacon, my business, my friends. If we are to practice natural body heal thyself medicine in New Zealand, if it is to have any chance of survival, it won't with the therapeutic products legislation. It's a death sentence for any doctor, nutritionist, naturopath, herbalist, or anybody else who wants to practice holistic medicine or healing, might be the better word. The therapeutic products legislation was going to threaten to put all of us out of business and give the citizens of New Zealand only one choice, and that is allopathic medicine and basically patent medicines, patent remedies and nothing else. So
is this bill Big Pharma fighting back or taking control, even more control?
I think it's I've referred to the idea of klepto globalists.
Yeah.
And it's basically kleptomaniacs who basically have got themselves in a position where they want to own absolutely everything, including humanity, our bodies and souls. Right. That's the way I see it. And they won't stop unless we push back firmly.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a couple of people in this industry that one of them's now got out of the industry because he could see where it was going, and he was selling supplements, and pretty good supplements too. I've used them myself, and I found them very beneficial. But people, they're having their livelihoods destroyed to control things that are actually not harmful, and I find it incredible. Yeah. That we've got a bill or an act in Parliament in place now that seeks to control things that are beneficial to people, not harming people.
Well, I've been trying to find the paper that was published about 15, 20 years ago. The coroner in Christchurch took a look at his records over the last 50 years for deaths from taking natural supplements like vitamins, and he found one death, and it was sadly a child that choked to death on a vitamin pill that his mother had given him. Right. Now that's in 50 years that was the only documented death that could be attributed to a vitamin supplement. Now the fact is that vitamins and minerals, when dispensed responsibly by people like myself, they're incredibly safe. And if they are to be regulated, they need to have their separate legislation that reflects the degree of risk. You can't lump a vitamin such as a vitamin C pill alongside a potent pharmaceutical drug. And they have completely different risk profiles.
Yeah,
and we need to separate it out. It needs to be there needs to be the legislation for drugs, big medicine, big surgery, that kind of thing, and then there needs to be legislation that covers natural health supplements. And by the way, the Fair Trading Act covers it. It's fine. You don't need any more. If we make a misrepresentation, then go and complain for false advertising. You know, and that'll sort it out. That's what happens now. It works fine.
Yeah. I mean, my experience is that there's a happy medium, isn't there, between therapeutics, treatments, vitamins, those sorts of things, healthy eating. You know, I mean, but that can only go so far. I mean, there's some significant issues with healthy eating in New Zealand anyway, because our soils don't contain certain elements within our soils, and so we've had to add things to foodstuffs. Classic cases: iodine being added to salt, right, or folate being added to bread. Those sorts of things. There are significant deficiencies within our soils, and therefore the foods that we grow, or the meats or the fishes that we eat, don't have those nutrients in them because they're just not in the environment that we are existing in. So we need to add to that.
Yeah, you're quite right. So, for example, New Zealand is extremely deficient in selenium. And in fact, the further south you go, the greater the deficiency. Down in the deep south, there used to be a problem with what was called white muscle disease in sheep and cattle.
Yeah.
The animals would miscarry, or when they were born, they would live for a few days and die from heart failure. And I always say to people, look, if you really want to learn about nutrition, go and consult a rural vet.
Yeah.
Okay. They really probably know more than a trained human nutritionist for human health. It's an interesting subject, and I should also point out that most of the food we eat nowadays is nutrient depleted.
Mm.
You have to look at what's put on the soil, and that includes all the imported food now. It's mostly grown in through industrial purposes, where the nutrients that are put on the soil are the ones that make the plants grow best, but that's not necessarily what makes human beings grow the best.
I understand completely. Because it's important, because it's telling you, it's telling listeners how you got to the point of wanting to make sure that there were politicians that were aware of the bigger picture on a lot of these things. And you came to the conclusion through your own personal experience that Winston Peters had a better grasp on the impacts of potential legislation than, you know, organizations like the National Party or indeed the ACT Party.
Well, more than that, Cam, it seemed like come hell or high water, all of the incumbent politicians were going to ram this legislation through. And that turned out to be the case. Despite the thousands of objections, I think it was at least 90% of the submissions were against it. And many of them were very well reasoned as well. They were serious concerns. But after the submissions had been heard, it was only a matter of weeks before they published their conclusions, and their legislation went through.
So you're experiencing disbelief, I guess, that this process happened like that. And I'm far more cynical. I've been involved in politics for a long time, and I have to educate people in other particular areas of interest that I share, especially around firearms. You know, everyone was saying submit on this bill, and I said, well, there's no point submitting. And they'd say to me, well, why? And I said, because they've already predetermined the outcome. And what they're doing is giving you the illusion of consultation. And so you're actually playing their game, and you're playing in the system. And then what they'll do is they'll take all of that consultation, they'll produce a pre-written summary that will say, well, thank you all very much for those opinions, but we're going to do this anyway because we think we know better than you. And that's the problem, isn't it, with politicians? They think they know better than us.
Well, yeah, and it even begs the question of somebody else pulling the strings. You know, who are they working for? Are they working for the best interests of New Zealand citizens, or are they working for the best interests of some other party? Okay. It does beg that question. And look, Cam, I didn't come down with the last shower either. And I saw the whole select committee process as being a sham.
Yeah.
And I put in the briefest of interviews. The briefest of submissions myself.
Yeah.
But decided, well, if we are not in the game, we can't complain. So we put in our submissions, and we knew that it was going to be just, you know, brushed over, and they were going to push it through. They were determined to push it through. We knew they were. Our only hope, right from the very beginning, before we put in any submissions at all, is we knew we had to get somebody into political power who could then basically on our behalf throw that legislation out and replace it with something that was more suitable, or in fact just leave it as it is. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And
yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? Politicians like to tinker and improve things, and they very often cause unintended consequences.
Well, the unintended consequences is that we have an increasingly unhealthy nation, and it's going to become even more unhealthy because they are now giving us the only option, and that is to repeat what has failed us miserably since the 1970s, which is basically a complete and utter reliance on patent medicines. Okay, oh, this is goes against this whole idea of our bodies being genetically programmed to move towards a state of perfect health. And all we have to do as health professionals is nurture that, to take a loving Mother Nature approach to health, rather than coming in with the let's smash and bro, okay? Come in with the big hit, you know, the B-52 napalm bombing raid, where you have the treatment was a success, however, the patient died, okay? That approach just does not work. We need to nurture. We need to cuddle. We need to use all of those nice, gentle terms. Food be thy medicine. There are all these sorts of concepts which go absolutely against the big pharma approach.
But it can take a different approach. I mean, I'll give you an example from my life, right? So I 5 years ago, pretty much, you know, on this weekend coming up will be 5 years since I had a rather severe stroke. You know, after the first 24 hours when it was really touch and go whether I was going to live or not, I started to think about how I was going to recover from this significant health event. You know, I had to do the obvious things, remove stress, you know, do a whole lot of things like that, restructure my life around all of that. But I started researching what causes strokes and what helps prevent strokes. And I came to, you know, within 2 days or so, I was following up on these threads and looking at peer-reviewed studies, you know, in reputable scientific papers and organizations that led me to the conclusion, and I haven't been disabused of this notion by anybody yet, that nicotine was the way that I could jumpstart fixing the neuroplasticity in my brain. And that nicotine and nicotine alone, and there's significant studies on this out of the FDA in the United States and other places around the world, that nicotine significantly aids in and is beneficial to developing neuroplasticity, and that strokes are caused by a lack of neuroplasticity, and that then causes a blood vessel to shatter or break, which is in your brain, which is essentially what a stroke is. And I was sitting there thinking, and so I said to the doctor, well, can I get some nicotine patches? Well, you're not a smoker. Well, do I have to start to get nicotine patches then? No. I said, I want nicotine patches. Why? I said, well, I need to get nicotine into my body. No, you can't do that. And everywhere I went was no, no, no in that first 2 weeks. And look, I don't like smoking cigarettes. They're horrible things. They're awful. They've got all sorts of other, you know, additives and things like that in there. And I very quickly came to the conclusion that I should either start smoking a pipe or cigars, because the only ingredients in pipe tobacco and cigars is tobacco, nothing else. And then I worked out that smoking one cigar a day, I found a study by the FDA in the United States that said 1 to 2 cigars a day has negligible negative health effects on you. A longitudinal study. But smoking one cigar gives you the equivalent of nicotine of one packet of cigarettes. So here I am, a week after having a stroke, trying to find ways to get nicotine into my body to help with neuroplasticity, being stopped by the very medical people who ignore these reports that are out there. And so I started smoking cigars, one a day. And people, you know, my doctor said, well, why are you doing that for? I told her, and I said, here's the studies. And she said to me, well, I have to disagree, but I can't argue with the evidence. Right? So when people say to me, why do you smoke cigars? Well, I smoke cigars for my health. And I've got empirical evidence to support that. But if you have a look at what the government has done, or all governments have done progressively over, you know, back when Helen Clark really started the anti-tobacco thing, there are actually some beneficial things that come from these products, one of which is nicotine. But all the legislation around smoking and around tobacco products is all about nicotine. But nicotine's not the problem, right? It's everything else that's around. The nicotine's the addictive element that's contained within those products. And so they focus on that and ignore the beneficial aspects. So, you know, my little journey was about diet and health and all of those things. But as part of that, I came to the conclusion I needed to start smoking cigars.
It's really fascinating, and you raise a couple of points here. There's increasing evidence that nicotine may be beneficial for offsetting some of the side effects from the mRNA COVID jab. I don't know whether you're aware of that. And the other point, Cam, which I think I must emphasize, is that nowadays is a time when it is the most wonderful time for us to be alive. Thank God for modern medicine.
Yeah.
Now, but we must clarify, thank God for modern emergency medicine.
Yep.
Right now, at this time, is the best time ever in history to suffer an acute medical event or accident, to be run over by a bus, to have a stroke, for example, because of the modern emergency medical treatments that are available.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. When it comes to preventing or rehabilitating after these events, when it comes to preventing diseases related to modern lifestyle, poor nutrition, exposure to toxins, aging, stress, those sorts of things, modern medicine, allopathic medicine, is a complete and utter failure. Okay? We must distinguish between medicine applied to those so-called degenerative or lifestyle or aging related conditions, and being run over by a bus or suffering a massive heart attack or a stroke.
Well, I mean, okay? You know, we don't have to look very far, though, to see where modern medicine or modern advice has failed us. Because if you look at society in New Zealand pre-1950, we were pretty fit and healthy. There wasn't a huge obesity issue amongst New Zealanders, and yet we have they call it an obesity epidemic now. And it always makes me laugh, because you can't catch obesity, right? It's not a virus. It's not a bacterium, right? It's a simple fact that you've oversupplied your body with energy, and it's decided to do what our body is designed to do when it has abundance, to store some of that energy for use at a later date, because we're probably going to go through some periods of scarcity. So the human body, we're fighting against evolution, really. The human body's designed to do that. And so we've got this obesity, they call it an obesity epidemic. And by saying it's an epidemic means that theoretically the solution is simple, take a pill or do something like that. But the reality is you actually need to expend more energy than you're putting in to avoid obesity. But nobody's prepared to use that as a solution. Now, you're a nutritionist, so you know exactly what I'm talking about here. It's the type of things, and I have done a bit of research in this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the food pyramid that started to be promoted in the 1950s is probably the cause of the obesity epidemic, because we're loading up on the very things that the human body finds toxic, and not eating the things that we actually need to do. And I've always found doing the opposite of the food pyramid that the medical professionals push has actually worked better for me, in that I eat more protein and eat more raw foods and not as many processed foods and much less grains or, you know, wheat and things like that that is right at the top, and that they tell us that that's what we should be eating the most of. And the reverse of that is actually true. And so you lose weight faster if you eat a high protein diet than you would if you ate, say, you know, a high gluten diet.
Yes, it's a little bit more complicated, but you're dead right. Look, I've got Dr. Kellogg's home medicine book. It's a huge volume, like a big Bible, which is a family heirloom that's been passed down through the generations of Mollers. And that was published about 1890.
Yep.
And Dr. Kellogg founded the Sanitarium Health Food Company.
Yep.
Now, it is said that somebody came up with the idea of cornflakes.
Yep.
And probably went to James Kellogg and said, "Hey, Doc, you know, I've got this. What do you reckon?" And the doc experimented with it, and he came up with a use for it, apparently, allegedly. And that was that it was used as a remedy for young or for unmarried men who could not control their urges. And so if,
not if mum and dad, successful then.
Well, if mum and dad, you know, caught Johnny doing something before he was married, he was sent off to Dr. Kellogg. And what Dr. Kellogg did was he fed them cornflakes to control those urges.
Right.
Now, so that was at Dr. Kellogg's sanatorium. Yeah. Okay. Now, somewhere along the way, they must have had another conversation which said, "Hey, you know, these are pretty tasty and they're pretty popular. So what do we do with it?" Well, somebody came up with the idea, breakfast being the most important meal of the day. But of course, I can remember, you know, having to get up in the morning. I'm a child from the 1950s. And the first person out of bed had to stoke the coals in the coal range. You couldn't cook the porridge, you couldn't cook the bacon and eggs or anything until you got the range roaring away with a fire. Yep. The other thing is, I put myself through university by milking cows. That was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so I never ate until about 9 o'clock in the morning.
The day always started. You expended a lot of energy for 5 hours.
Yeah, hard physical labor without even a glass of water. Now, if you look at the islands, you look at Samoa, where my partner, her mum and dad came from, okay, people got up before the crack of dawn and often walked several kilometers up to the fields to weed and to harvest the taro and so on. Others would be on the reef fishing, and then others would be preparing the fire to be able to cook the meal. And by the time everything was gutted, prepared and dressed and so on, and then put into the ground with the rocks, nobody had a meal until midday.
Mm.
So breakfast was never the most important meal of the day. It is a modern construct, and its purpose is to sell convenience foods that don't require cooking.
Okay. And most of them are loaded with sugar.
And of course, it's all because it's so easy. You can put cornflakes in a packet, and then all you have to do is add milk, and Bob's your uncle. Okay, so that's how it came about. Now, more recently, particularly if you're dealing with young and active people, the message being sent out to nutritionists was that you need to fuel up every 2 hours. And what better way of doing that than to buy yourself some muesli bars, especially the high protein ones, okay? Yeah. But again, it's a sugar hit. So we've been basically brainwashing people to believe that every 2 hours they've got to have a snack. Now,
breakfast, morning tea, lunch, afternoon tea, dinner, supper.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the pioneering New Zealanders, you know, your Colin Meads and your Lahores and all of them, and I even think of my grandparents and the men and the women in my family, they were all big, strong, rock-jawed men and women. They were strong.
Okay? And fueled by protein. Good.
Well, yes, and they didn't snack in between, and they didn't even start with breakfast. You know, we've been fed a load of cobblers, and the end result is that it's almost as if the whole of New Zealand is pre-diabetic and obese. Okay.
And but you look at all of those things that you're talking about for breakfast and lunch, and you know, they all involve breads, wheat, all of these sorts of things, right? You know, I've noticed cutting wheat out of my diet as much as possible. I mean, even having oat type breads. You know, and I look back on my youth, Mum used to make us, especially in winter, used to make us porridge, of course, which is rolled oats. Now, I've found that if I have wheat in my diet, I end up with a crook gut. I put on weight quite quickly. But if I reduce that wheat down to a manageable amount and limit when I have that, and that is usually at breakfast in the form of, you know, a couple of slices of toast, but I'm using oat-based breads now rather than wheat, that my weight just falls off because I don't add any more of the wheat and the things that go with that, like sandwiches and all of those. And we send kids off to school with bread, you know, and sugary stuff that's based around all of that. And they're leading a sedentary lifestyle. And we wonder why they're putting weight on and they're obese. Because we're actually filling them up with the wrong sort of stuff at the wrong time.
So there are a couple of things there, Cam. One of the most effective health measures that somebody can do diet-wise is simply to reduce or eliminate grains.
Yeah.
And in particular, wheat and rice. Oats might be a little bit better, okay? And there are other grains as well. But to move away from the most industrially produced grains would be a good move, because by default, all grains, carbohydrates, are ultimately sugar.
Yeah.
And so by default, if somebody just simply cuts out those primary sources of grains, they are reducing their sugar intake. The other thing is that sugar is pro-inflammatory. Sugar feeds bugs like yeast, viruses, bacteria, and so on, parasites. So if you eliminate carbohydrates, primarily grains, by default, you are going to become healthier. And
end up with more energy too. I've found that I've had more energy by cutting those grains out. And you know, I don't go to extremes. Like, I prefer to eat wild type rices, you know, ancient type rices rather than, you know, your jasmine.
There's another factor as well. Industrially produced grains tend to be sprayed with glyphosate.
Right.
Okay. And glyphosate is a herbicide. It is a terrible poison. I've written a few articles on the subject. And it's, if somebody cuts out their commercially produced non-organic grains, by default, they will be reducing their exposure to glyphosate.
Yep.
Glyphosate is used as a crop ripener. Just go into Google and type glyphosate and crop ripener and be prepared to be shocked at what you see. And when glyphosate combines with gluten, it effectively renders the gluten into a toxin. Now, that might explain why somebody with a gluten intolerance can go to the south of France or Spain and eat the pastries and not have a problem. That is one of the theories, in that it's not necessarily the gluten that is the main issue. It is the gluten when it's combined with glyphosates.
Well, this is, you know, we've gone from talking about politics to talking about diet and those things, right?
We're digressing.
But there's a reason for that, right? So, and let's just touch back on the nicotine and the diet, right? Yeah. So I'm not vaccinated for COVID-19, right? Mm. I've never worn a mask. I've never practiced any of the rules and regulations, and I was never locked down. I did whatever I wanted, right? And I'm admitting that openly on radio that I did whatever I wanted. But I've also never caught COVID. And, you know, I was smoking cigars once a day during the lockdowns. In fact, it was delightful because I had the time. It takes a long time to smoke a cigar. It takes over an hour for even a small one to smoke. And I'm picking that that nicotine is what was stopping me catching COVID when everybody else was having it. And then with the diet that I was having, which also included supplements, including zinc, vitamin D3, and vitamin C, on top of the nicotine, was what stopped that. And then we talk about the diet. And now we get to where I'm heading. Mm. Aren't we fighting our own DNA by following these prescriptive solutions, you know, to fight obesity for one, that we're fighting our own DNA and our own ability of our body to fight things off naturally? Mm. And you've written an article about this in particular. Yes. Then that's what interested me to get you on this show, that melding of politics and understanding our DNA and where that's going from. And you've written an article and you've called it Safeguarding Life's Sacred Code, Protecting DNA and Our Precious Planet, which is on your website, garymoller.com. Mm. And I found that really fascinating, where you talk about DNA as being a sacred God script. And now we're talking about why we need to be looking at this genetic engineering, genetically modified organisms, the therapeutics bill, all of these things are combining to ankle tap us and take us away from what you call as the God script, the sacred God script of DNA.
Yes, and this is one of the reasons why opposing the therapeutic products bill, which is now legislation, is now an act.
Now, yep.
I believe that the reason why they had to get this legislation through is because it is the mechanism for the fast-track approval of novel new medicines, including mRNA or gene-related therapies.
Yeah.
And that's why they were going to put it through, whether the public wanted it or not. It had to go through. There is now an infrastructure in place for the production of millions of doses of mRNA drugs in New Zealand, and there are research projects galore around the country in our universities and so on, all geared up to produce mRNA drugs for every imaginable plant, animal, and human use in New Zealand.
And that's the thing, isn't it? They're going to apply this first to animals and to plants, which means that we will then be ingesting these modified organisms, whether we like it or not.
The person to talk to on this is Dr. Guy Hatchard, who we all know well. Basically, we share our DNA with every other living organism that we know. We talk to our environment, and we principally talk to our environment through our food. And we need to be extremely careful, because we share our DNA and plants share their DNA with us, plants and animals, anything, even possibly through inhalation. Okay. We can't separate ourselves from basically whatever that life force is out there. Okay. I'm not religious, but there is some kind of life force. And DNA seems to be the closest to us understanding what it is, but there's something far greater. All life is one, and we must be very careful. And if you look at all the great religions, one of the common messages, overriding messages, is that man should never be so arrogant as to think he can play God or be God. It always ends in disaster. And here is the ultimate of man attempting to play God. And we don't understand what we are doing, but we know that whenever man has attempted to play God, they have failed terribly. And my message is don't go down there. And especially, we haven't had the opportunity for a free and open discussion of the science and the ethics of it. Where's the conferences? Where's the debates? Okay, it's just being foisted down our throats.
Well, we saw this during the COVID pandemic where no debate was even entered into. If you tried to debate the merits of compulsory vaccination and mRNA vaccines and everything, you were labeled a conspiracy theorist, a cooker, a nutter. You know, you were demonized if you said, well, hang on a second here. And, you know, I can remember when they were talking about these mRNA vaccines, a very good friend of mine, one of Cam's buddies who's, you know, regularly on the radio, would say to me, he said to me, Cam, we don't want to be doing this. He said, I studied mRNA when I was at university. This is a fundamental change to our core code. And I said, whoa, I'm struggling to understand this, as he explained it further. Mm. And I said, I need an analogy that the everyday person can understand. And he says, well, Cam, you're into computers. This is like somebody designing a piece of code that they claim will run flawlessly on every computer that's ever been built by man, irrespective of the language that was used to build the, you know, the instruction code of that original computer or the latest computer you've got. These people are telling you that they've written a piece of code that is universal to every single computer. And your body is your own unique computer that's made up of DNA and mRNA strands and instructions. And they're saying, here, apply this piece of code to your computer and it's going to work flawlessly. And I said to him, that's nuts. It can't possibly work. My DNA is different from yours. You're short and fat and I'm not so short and slightly thinner. That's our genetic makeup. You yourself, Gary, you're much thinner than I am, you know, so that's perhaps your DNA, perhaps you're helping your DNA by your diet, but everyone's different. And yet we were told, here's this thing that everyone can take. And worse, they said it was safe and effective.
Yeah, completely unsafe and completely ineffective. We've got to realize that it's now Orwellian doublespeak. Well, whatever is the truth is, in fact, the lie.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It really is. It's almost like they picked up 1984 from George Orwell and didn't take it as a warning, which is what he intended, right? Took it as a manifesto or an instruction book and then melded
it. Yeah, so they use a manual.
Yeah, they use a manual. And then they said, well, we need some other things here to make it more palatable. So then they picked up Mein Kampf and also the writings of of Goebbels, right, and mixed it all together and gave us this safe and effective. If you take these vaccines, you won't get sick and you won't die. Those were the exact words that Jacinda Ardern used, and politicians all around the world, Joe Biden, many others said, if you take these vaccines, it'll stop you getting COVID. Well, that's not the case.
Well, and in fact, it'll start you getting COVID. It does the opposite as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, the things you took like zinc, especially if it's combined with other nutrients which help to pull the zinc into your cells, you probably caught COVID, but you probably never knew it. You see,
if I did, it was really mild, it didn't even notice.
Well, it's really, it's not a case of whether you catch a disease or not. Look, I've been exposed, I would guess, to every bug under the sun, including every herpes infection you can think of. But it comes down to not so much whether you catch things, it comes down to symptoms.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, whether you have mild symptoms or whether you have life-threatening symptoms. And this is where having a robust body through good nutrition, good lifestyle, sleep, you know, stress management, etc. These are the keys. Okay, it's not about whether or not you catch the disease; it's how your body manages the disease and ultimately develops a degree of immunity resistance to further infections. And that's what we should be focusing health on. Now, by the way, let's just digress a little wee bit.
Again.
You were talking about, this is wide-ranging, you're talking about the 1950s, okay?
Mm.
Now, I can remember the 1950s, and there was a health crisis. We really did have a post-war health crisis. Now, our wise and very practical forefathers, my parents and my grandparents, they came up with the solutions. And by the way, politicians were not career politicians back then.
No.
They were people who had been successful in their own right, who then felt it their civic duty to give back to society. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, so what did they do? They embarked on a basically a public health program, putting in sewerage. I can remember when the sewer line was dug in and we got rid of the outhouse, okay? They put in water treatment, reticulated water. They came up with the Sunshine School design, which is a fascinating concept.
It's all around vitamin D, isn't it?
There was a dental nurse. Yeah, there was a dental nurse in just about every primary school. The local farmers were contracted to supply a half pint of fresh full cream milk for every primary school child. Mm. Postage stamps were used to fund health camps.
Yeah.
And we had the Plunkett nurse and so on. Now, those, if you think of those are primary health investments. New Zealand went from a health crisis to being within the top three or four countries in the world for health measures. We were competing with Finland, Sweden, Norway for child health, for being the healthiest place to raise a child. Then from the mid-1970s, we began our love affair with patent medicine. Mm. And we were the second country in the world around 1980, somewhere around there, to allow direct-to-customer television advertising of pharmaceuticals. The United States was the first.
Yeah.
And we have deteriorated now to the point where we're competing to be in the bottom three in the developed world for health. Mm. Okay, we've gone the complete opposites. It's a disaster. And what this current setup is that they are now not just asking us, but they're forcing us to do more of the same. More of what has failed us, to spend more money on basically patent medicines when they have failed us terribly. We need to go back to the basics of investment. By the way, I forgot to mention as well the state housing program. Hey, the government back there, they built suburbs and suburbs of the most beautiful modern homes.
Mm.
Okay. And we've had a government that seemed to struggle to build one.
Yeah.
I'm exaggerating, but you get the idea.
No, I mean, you know, I've used the analogy that if you sat them in a room full of Lego, they couldn't build a house. You know, so I mean, you're exactly right. We've had these politicians, and I'll call them academic politicians, right? Mm-hmm. They're book-learned politicians who think that if you just apply more money, or if we order people to do things, that it will just happen. You know, a case in point is KiwiBuilt, where Phil Twyford said, "Oh, we'll get this happening But there's no way that the government had the capacity to build a house, even a single house, that they were going to have to rely on the private sector. But there was no connection between slogans, election slogans, and the reality. And that's what I fear about MMP and where we're heading. And I detect that's what you fear as well, which is why we've kind of started this discussion, you and I, is, you know, you wanted to see New Zealand First come in because you felt they had good solutions. But we're sitting there with National Party being dominant, aided by the ACT Party, which is, you know, they're not too dissimilar in their global outlook on things, seemingly beholden to solutions that aren't solutions. And you've got this bulwark of New Zealand First there, hopefully, who can say, no, we need to pull out of this. We need to stop this. I mean, there's some drop-dead dates with the therapeutics bills, isn't there? Where if we don't pull out by the 1st of December, then we're kind of screwed.
Yes, you're right. We are. And our big hope, what we did hope for, Cameron, was getting sufficient New Zealand First MPs and other independents with similar views into Parliament so that we held the balance of power. And one of the negotiable, well, there were a number of things we want to negotiate. And one of them, of course, is the repeal of the Therapeutic Products Act.
Yeah.
It needed to go. If that was the only thing to go, that would have been a wonderful victory. There also needed to be other things, of course, like a proper, free and open review, investigation into the COVID response, including this whole issue of vaccine injuries. We needed to, and we still need to have this debate about the science and the ethics of gene therapies.
That is
crucial. But unfortunately, because of big egos,
hubris, arrogance, and egos, ego.
We're down several MPs on where we should be. What should have happened is that the parties that were obviously the one percenters, this needed to, a decision needed to be made about 2 weeks before polling booths opened, that the one percenters needed to honourably step aside. Look, Cameron, I relate this to like running a marathon. I've run many marathons. My sister went to four Olympics running marathons. And even though it's an individual competition where there's only one winner, and it can be one winner out of 1,000, you know, most of us are condemned to being losers in life, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't enthusiastically participate. But here's the thing, okay? It's actually a cooperative effort where, so when the marathon starts, and you just watch any big marathon, they run together, they help, they pull each other along, they assist, they might even share a drink amongst each other. But when you come then to the last, there comes a point where there's a crunch point where you say, okay, there's now going to be one winner. And people then make their moves, okay? And there's a winner. And at the end, you congratulate and you shake hands for a race well run, a race well fought. Now, the problem with that happened here is that come hell or high water, those one percenters were not going to concede that they'd lost the race.
Yeah.
Okay. They weren't. And in
fact, they ignored polls. They ignored everything.
They went a step further and they started to try and trip. Okay, you just imagine running in a running race where you're getting towards the end and it's becoming obvious who's winning. So what do? You say,
ankle tap them.
Go for it, Freddie. Go for it, Cam. Okay, you've got it here, mate. You know, go. Or you trip them up. Okay, give you a foot trip. Righto? Yeah. And that's what they resorted to. It was obvious 2 weeks out that Winston was our only hope. New Zealand First, Winston. Okay?
Yeah.
So... yeah, sure. The media went nuclear on Winston.
David Seymour went nuclear on Winston.
Yes, they did. But what was unforgivable, that was understandable because, hey, Winston was going to be a threat to their $55 million slush fund anyway.
Yep.
But what was unforgivable was the other members of the so-called freedom movement, they started to play dirty, okay, with innuendos, with allegations, which in my view bordered on being defamatory.
Yeah.
And with the result is that they were like a bunch of captains of ships in a convoy, and one by one they're being torpedoed and they're going under. And they were saying, saying to the crew, you know, and the passengers, don't worry, we're not going under, you know, there's going to be a miracle. By the way, we're going to get 2 million votes. Don't know where they're going to come from, but we're going to get 2 million. You know, we had all this. And so the end result is they not only took themselves under, but they put everybody, well, not everybody, but they put so many other people off. There's already enough damage being done by the mainstream media without them adding to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, our
goal. It's a tragedy, really, when you think about it.
It is. We had to get the maximum number of votes. We needed to get MPs in Parliament. That was the goal. It was not about stroking egos.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
No, 100% agree with you. And that was what I was trying to educate people with my show. That,
yes. You know, yeah.
Talking to all of these different people.
You did a damn good job, Cam. You did a good job.
But we just got to try, you know. And you know, I've been involved in politics all of my life. And I go by my gut feel. And, you know, I also based on empirical evidence, is you can't deny evidence. And that's what I said to Matt King, you know, let's do a poll. You know, if the poll shows you're going to come fourth, well, then will you just give up? And he said, no, I'm not coming fourth. I'm going to win. Well, guess where he came? Fourth, right? Which is what the poll, there were three polls done in Northland and every single one of them said Matt King's coming fourth. And that's exactly where he came, but yet he carried on. And Democracy New Zealand carried on the basis that Matt King was going to win Northland. Ultimately, you know, with hindsight, which is always 2020, it was dishonest. The same as the claim we're going to get there by winning, you know, Justin Southland. There's enough votes there to get 5% if everyone in Southland votes for us. It was dishonest. It was demonstrably false. And now we see, you know, over the past weekend, Liz Gunn saying, I was just joking about the 2 million votes. No, she wasn't. Yeah. I saw the video. She was deadly serious. I don't know whether it was a delusion or if it was a deliberate falsehood, but it led people to believe in something that didn't exist. And if that 1% from NZ Loyal had gone New Zealand First and that 1% from Democracy New Zealand had gone to New Zealand First, there would now be three additional MPs in the House in the form of Kirsten Murphitt and Lee Donoghue. Yep. You know, and a couple of others that were clearly freedom candidates who now are relying on special votes and may or may not get there. And that's a tragedy, an absolute tragedy that could have been avoided.
Yeah. One of the things that one of the rather despicable tactics that was used, Cam, was this myopic focus on Winston.
Mm.
What was constantly ignored was the fact that behind Winston was a dedicated team of extremely competent people and an impressive set of manifesto or election promises.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Many of those people, you mentioned a few names, are people who were our friends. Okay, friends of Liz Gunn, of Matt King, and so on. And they let them down. They betrayed them. That was the thing. They said, no way are we going to go with Winston. Winston can't be trusted, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and the National
and
Party
attack totally
lines.
Ignoring the team that was backing Winston.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've seen it for years. You know, the National Party spent 30 years trying to destroy Winston Peters.
Yes.
Right. And that, and those are the exact lines that you use. That's what the National Party has been saying, and National Party adherents have been saying about Winston Peters for 30 years or more. And the these freedom parties took up that cudgel and used it. I mean, it, I was even subject to a rather defamatory and outrageous attack by a supposed media organization that described what I was doing to educate voters was a psyop, and that I was a creature of the National Party. Just outrageous allegations. But that caused damage. That caused damage to, as you say, the, those really fine people that, could have been in Parliament sitting there working out how we could do that.
I feel really sad for the people who were let down by their leaders. Those leaders, and some of them I've always regarded as friends, but they may not. I'm still their friend, but they may not think of me as their friend anymore. But that's the way it is. But they need to now be eating humble pie. They need to be coming to us, and they need to be apologising.
That's the sad thing, Gary. Well, you know, as they won't. They won't do that because of the narcissism, because of the hubris, because of the arrogance. And it's you know, I describe it as a tragedy, and it is. It was a missed opportunity, and we've just got to work harder.
Cam, one of the things that I've learned, one of the hardest words, first of all, is to say no.
Yeah.
But what's even harder is to say sorry. I'm sorry. I got it wrong. Now, what can I do to make the best of what might be a bad thing? Okay, that's really hard to do. But I think with practice, it actually becomes easier. And because I practice that a lot nowadays. So where do we go from here? What I think, this is what I want people to do. We need to now think 3 years ahead. We need to think about the next election. Now, can I make one point?
Yeah.
Because of this lost opportunity by overinflated, bullheaded egos, people are dying. People are being maimed, okay?
Yeah.
We have to now face another 3 to 4 years before anything changes. And in fact, things may get worse.
Mm.
People are dying. And that's one of the things that that was completely overlooked when these people said, no way, I'm going to push on, even though I've only got 1%. You know, we're going to get the 200,000 votes, the 2 million, sorry, 2 million votes, and so on. They are costing people's lives. People are being maimed because it allows these lies to continue. We must not forget that, okay?
No. I'm with you 100% on that.
Yeah. Now, it means nothing's going to change for another 3 years and probably another year after that.
At least.
Okay? At least. So,
And this is just the point I was making to these smaller parties, right? The ACT Party has been in existence for 35 years. New Zealand First has been in existence for 30 years. That's how long it takes you to get to a credible force in Parliament. You can't expect overnight that you'll get 5%, 6%, 10% overnight. It is a intergenerational journey, and not one single one of those leaders is prepared to embark on that intergenerational journey. Because it requires discipline, it requires patience, and it requires dedication. And none of them have that.
Sadly. Yes, it takes, you're right. That was one of the reasons for associating with an existing political party, even if we didn't completely like what was there.
That's right.
There's no point in trying to recreate an incredibly complex machine. It's not just a wheel,
It's not easy.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated.
Yeah. Yes, it takes time to build the infrastructure and to weed out the crackpots as well, by the way.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So the idea, which we need to continue, is to say, okay, New Zealand First has welcomed us with open arms.
Yeah.
There's been no subterfuge or what have you.
But okay? You know, a point you raised before about the ability to say sorry, that was the first interview, one of my first shows, right, I had with Winston Peters.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, you were part of the government that brought in these mandates. And he acknowledged that he was wrong.
Hmm.
He said that it was, knowing what he knows now, he wished he hadn't done that.
Hmm.
And then in a second interview that I had with him, I said, you know, do you remember Alan Martin used to have the LV Martin ads? And he would always say, it's the putting right that counts. And Winston said, yep. And that's why I'm back. That's why I've come back into the parliament, so that I can right the wrongs. Yep. And I believe him. I've seen the resolve in him that he knows that he was wrong. He's said it out loud, which not very many politicians do.
Hmm.
And now it's up to him to grow New Zealand First. And it's up to us and people like the audience here on Reality Check Radio need to get behind that, become involved in those. Don't sit back and expect someone else to do it. Right? Go and join those political parties. Go and join the National Party and change them one branch at a time, one electorate at a time. Go and join the ACT Party and change them one branch, one electorate at a time. And go and join New Zealand First and power them up so that they aren't a party that disappears after 30 years, that they go on and they're there for another 30 years. And they are looking for the benefits for New Zealand, not for other countries.
Yes, this is really good stuff. We become the party, and the party becomes us.
Correct.
And if you don't become part of the party, if you don't get involved, and it ends up not representing your views, then don't complain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If your involvement in the electoral process is that you go and vote once every 3 years, well, you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah, I actually think that not being involved, well, the real power in politics actually happens at the party level. We need to be involved there. The casting of the votes is like going to a Turkish restaurant and expecting French to be served.
Yeah,
okay.
And complaining that there's no baguettes on the table.
Yeah, I know.
Where's the croissants? You're at a Turkish restaurant, but I want croissants.
If you want a party to provide you with the kinds of policies and to deliver on them, you've got to get involved at the party level. Otherwise, when it comes to casting your vote, well, you're just going to have to accept whatever they serve.
Well, there's an old military saying, right, that comes from, at the end of sieges, when the walls are finally breached, what the generals would do is they would send in a forlorn hope, right, where it was led by a junior officer and a sergeant and a bunch of reprobates. And if they survived the battle, then they were promoted. But they were called the forlorn hope because there was a very high chance that going through that breach, they were never going to come back. And that's what these minor parties are often, are the forlorn hope who get mowed down as they go into the breach. I think what we've discussed today, you know, we've been wide ranging. We've gone from politics to health, back to politics, and then into solutions for the future. It requires these courageous discussions where we're unafraid to actually say what went wrong and try and rectify that. And, you know, people like yourself who've put themselves out there, had a website, you know, put your opinions out there. Those are the people that we should be listening to. People like yourself, people like us here at Reality Check Radio, because we've got our head above the parapet and, you know, but we need other people to join in that fight. And so, yeah, I've really enjoyed talking to you today about this. And, I'm pretty sure this is going to be one of the most replayed interviews that I've had in a long time too, because it's so wide-ranging.
Forlorn defeat or glorious in victory?
Well, I prefer to look on things to be glorious in victory. No one likes coming second, right? You used your sporting analogies in marathons. Does anyone ever remember who came second in the New York Marathon in 1988? Nobody does, yeah. Right? Or who won the silver medal in any of the Olympics for marathons? Nobody remembers them, right? So glorious victory.
For those in the know, we know that for there to be a victor, there must be others.
Many, many losers.
There's many, many losers, and there's nothing to be ashamed of or to be depressed about by not winning.
But you've got to give it a go.
Absolutely, the icing on the cake.
Yep.
And it's an extremely rare experience for the vast majority of us. But I've spent my entire life getting beaten. I've been winning lately, but it's mainly because I waited for all my opposition to die off.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? You wear them down. It's like, you know, people keep, said to me, you know, you're irrelevant or that, and yet the people who are saying that are the ones who are listening.
Okay, so, I'm doing a Winston, or maybe Winston's doing a Gary. He's following me.
Well, on that note, Gary, thank you so much for coming on The Crunch. I really appreciate your time.
That's a pleasure.
I really seem to get distracted sometimes, and I did it again with Gary because we ranged far and wide in the interview, and it's something that I do these days. But I find it energizing and invigorating to discuss lots of different topics. He's a fascinating and thoroughly likable bloke, and it was a real pleasure to discuss health, nutrition, politics, and the lost opportunities with him today. Don't forget to send comments on Gary's interview to inbox@realitycheck.radio or text to 2057.
This is The Crunch with Cam Slater. Conversations with a side of controversy, right here on RCR.